chachma on this parsha. This is parsha Kla'ira. And we know that one of the mitzvos that you're mechuyev to do the first night of Pesach is to drink 4 cups of wine. And although that's midrabanan, it's not a doraisa, but the chachamim base the 4 cups of wine on the 4 l'shainais of geula that appear when Moshe, when Hashem promises Moshe, right? Lochem emor b'nei Yisrael, tell b'nei Yisrael, I am Hashem, v'hotseisi, I will take them out, v'hitzalti, I will save them, v'go'alti, I will redeem them, v'lokachti, I will take them unto me for a nation, dalit l'shainais of geula. Dalit l'shainus of Geula is the reason why we have 4 cups of wine. Right? Everyone knows that as a familiar reason. Now, I'll leave with the MS. There is, of course, a fifth term for Geula, because Hashem then says, V'heveisi eschem el ha'aretz. I will bring them to the land. That is why there's actually a mandiyamar in the Gemara, Rabbi Tarfon, who says you're mechuyev to have 5 cups of wine. Now, it's interesting. It's very, very fascinating that if you learned Avri Pesachim with just the commentary of Rashi and the Rashbam, you wouldn't even know this, because the Rashbam changes the girsa of Rabbi Tarfon to a 4th cup. In other words, the girsa has changed. So according to the Rashbam, there is no reference to Kais Chamish in the Gemara at all. But many Rishonim have a girsa that Rabbi Tarfon is Mechayev a Kais Chamish, and there are Hasidim to this day that have 5 cups of wine at the Seder. The Maral's Haggadah says, L'chatchili, you should have that. The Maral's Haggadah says it. But some say that that was a forgery. Again, some claim the Maral didn't say it, and Hasidim put it into the Maral's Haggadah. So be it as it may. Whether it's the Maral or somebody who put something into the Maral, we don't know for sure. But of course, we don't. We don't have a 5th cup. And the reason why we don't have a 5th cup is actually 2 reasons. Why don't I have a 5th cup? So one reason is because the ultimate fulfillment of Hashem bringing us to the land was not yet Mekuyim, because that refers to the final coming of the land, Limos HaMashiach, when there will never be a Golus again. And even though we're in Eretz Yisrael, right, but we're still in Golus, we don't have a Beis HaMikdash, therefore the Hevesi has not been Mekuyim yet. The second reason is Vehevesi is not part of the Geula. The Geula is taking us out of Mitzrayim. Where he takes us to is a separate thing, but it's not a chelik of Geula. But be it as it may, because of this 5th lashon, we actually do have a 5th cup that we don't drink at the Seder, and that is, of course, the kos of Eliyahu Hanavi. Actually, Sfardim, the Minhag Sfardim is not to have it, although many Sfardim copied Ashkenazim, but Ashkenazim have a kos of Eliyahu. And why is it called the Eliyahu's cup? So countless generations of parents have told their children Eliyahu HaNavi visits every house and he takes a sip from the cup. I don't know if you used to do this, but kids like to watch the cup to be see if it goes down a little bit. And when they go to the bathroom or they turn away, you know, the father pours out some wine and says, see, it went down. I mean, Havdol Mei Havdalos, it's similar to the Santa Claus games that they have. For Havdil, of course, that was they have for children. But the real reason why it's called Eliyahu's Kos is not because Eliyahu drinks from the Kos, but it's because Eliyahu is the one who's going to announce the coming of Mashiach. So essentially what we're saying is, even though we don't drink the cup now, but we're saving the cup from when Eliyahu HaNavi comes, and then we're going to drink that 5th cup, because there'll be a fulfillment of Hevesi. That's why it's called Kais Shel Eliyahu. So I want to share with you a thought of the Meshech Chachma, which is not actually it's not what I said in the other shir. So you'll hear something new. The one person was at the other shir too. And the Meshech Chachma asked the question: why do I have 4 lashonas of Geula? Mitzrayim is one thing, right? Why 4 lashonas of Geula? So he says the following. He says, because in fact, in slavery in Mitzrayim, there were 4 different nisyanos, 4 different challenges Klal Yisrael faced. And Hashem had to redeem us from those 4 different challenges. And this is what the Meshech Chachma says. Challenge number one, or danger number one that we faced, was physical survival. Right? Our very lives were endangered. The Egyptians, number one, killed babies. They would throw babies into the Nile. They would put babies into the bricks. And Bichlal, people die of difficult slavery, right? Concentration camps. Besides the fact that the Nazis killed people, but many people would die from malnutrition. They would die from the severity of the work. So one danger that we faced in Mitzrayim was simply the danger to our physical lives. We need a redemption from that. A second danger that we face in Mitzrayim is to our spiritual identities. We became assimilated to the culture of Mitzrayim. Right? What do Chazal say? We should have been in Mitzrayim 400 years. We're only there 210 years because we had hit the 49th level of Tumah. Had we stayed there, not just another 190 years, had we stayed there another minute, we would have hit level number 50. We would have disappeared. As it were, remember that when we say the Yidden hit level 49, we are talking about the 20% that merited to leave. 80% died. The 80% had hit the 50th level. Right? In fact, that's even the Remez. It says, right, Rashi brings the Medrash, that 4/5 of the Jewish people died during the 3 days of darkness. That's why Hashem, right? But you have to understand that there's a double entendre here. They died, you know, during the plague of darkness, but they also died because of their darkness, their own inner darkness, their own not understanding Hashem, not serving Hashem, etc. Right? That's why they died in Bedavki in the plague of darkness. They didn't die in another plague or something like that. So danger number one is danger to our physical lives. Danger number two is danger to our spiritual lives. Yeah. Well, that depends how literally you take the Medrash. The Medrash seems to indicate that they didn't die until the plague of darkness. Perhaps they didn't reach the 50th level or whatever. Perhaps the Makos themselves could have been an opportunity that they could have done tshuva. But by the time they didn't do tshuva after the first seven, right? That's one way of looking at it, in which case they were saved until the plague of darkness, which is plague number nine. The other way of looking at it is, if you take the whole Medrash in a non-literal way, the Medrash is actually not telling you when they died, it's just attributing their death to their own darkness. So you might understand the Medrash in a few different ways. Now, the third danger is already a bit more subtle, and that is a slave does not have a sense of history. I don't know if you recall this as before you were born, but in the 70s, there was a fellow, a black writer, who wrote a book about roots. He had traced his family, you know, movie and play, all sorts of things. He tracing his background from the African, apparently, you know, his ancestors were slaves in the United States. But if you go beyond that, they were kings and princes, and, you know, they had all these empires in Africa. And one of the cruel effects of slavery is that families were broken up, children were separated from parents, and people had no sense of their history. They had no sense that they came from something. It's as if they spontaneously generated from the dirt. A slave has no sense of roots, has no sense of past, has no sense of being connected to something chashuv. That's a great, great tragedy. You know, there's an old saying, if you don't know where you come from, you don't know where you need to go. Okay? That a sense of a past. In fact, that's a tragedy that many Jews have today. You know, we don't know our own families, really. I mean, it's an amazing thing. This is, I don't know if I may have mentioned it before, and, you know, it's really obvious, but I'll repeat it. And that is, any single person who is Jewish today, I don't mean from, who is Jewish today, had at least a great-grandparent who was religious. Because if somebody wasn't religious 100 years ago, they don't have descendants who are still Jewish. Because that's how people disappear. In other words, anyone, let's say, who was a Reformed Jew 150 years ago does not have any Jewish descendants. Right? So if somebody is Jewish, now, even if they're marginally Jewish, in other words, even if they barely do anything at all or do nothing at all, but if they identify themselves as Jewish, it is because four or five generations at most, maybe more, maybe less, were keeping mitzvahs. So when you go back to keeping mitzvahs, it's not like you're doing something new. you're going back to what your family was doing for thousands and thousands of years. If there was a break, the break was very, very recent. Now, recent, I think recent could mean, you know, 20 years. Recent could be 150 years. But not more than really 150 years. I mean, that's an absolute maximum. Because a Yiddishkeit without Torah, or a Jewish identity without Torah, is like a branch that you cut off from a tree. It's just going to die. It may survive for a while, because there's sap in the branch for a limited amount of time, but it's going to die. So if it's still around, it's because it's still connected to the tree. Yeah.
I've heard that before. Does the Rav mean people who identify as Jewish, or just people who are Jewish? Because people, I think, would be Jewish even if they don't know. Five or six generations in the future.
Well, okay. Number one, the probabilities of intermarriage when you were cut off from mitzvahs is overwhelming. So if there's a non-Jewish woman there, so you've stopped the chain right there. But l'chol ha'pachos, I think it would be so that they wouldn't even know that they're Jewish. I think that's true. So not knowing our past is really a very, very tragic and sad thing. Somebody told me, a Frum professor in a law school told me that he had a student who looked like he wasn't involved in Judaism at all. And he went over to him after class once and said, and this professor actually looks like a Yerushalmi Haredi. He has a long, long beard. And he even wears a kapata, but you know, he teaches in a law school. He's also a Bucky in Shas. He's a very, very chashuv person. But the person went over to him and said to him, you know, you look like you're a rabbi, etc. And I just want to know, you know, somebody told me I have a rabbi who was very, very famous. His name was Elijah, and he lived in Vilna, Lithuania, around 250 years ago. This is the Vilna Gaon. Vilna Gaon. The person didn't even realize what it was to be descended. How many people would, like, you know, give up their fortunes if they could be descended from the Vilna Gaon? You know, to this kid, it was not even a significant fact, just a curiosity, a little bit. But, you know, who knows? Who knows? Perhaps as he learns more about it, that might inspire him. So if the first nisayon is the difficulty of physically surviving, and the second nisayon is spiritually surviving, the third nisayon is a slave has a lack of history. And the fourth, the Meshech Chochmah says, the Or Sameach says, is lack of hope. When a person is crushed and persecuted for so many years, they lose a sense of hope that things can ever be better, that things can ever change. That's a very, very critical point. You know, the notion of hope, HaKadosh Baruch Hu created us in such a way that there really is a mind over matter. There is a concept that what you think is true becomes the reality of your life. If you think things can never be better, and this is true, by the way, not only in slavery, this is true in Avodas Hashem. If you think things can never be better, then indeed that becomes the reality. Even in medical treatment, you know, when people are very, very ill, when a person truly gives up hope, the body itself begins a process of shutting down that's actually irreversible. Because, like, the body kind of just... You know, even people who believe in, you know, voodoo, you know, people make these dolls and they stick a pin in. So there's some anecdotal medical evidence that if you believe in voodoo, then when somebody makes a doll of you and sticks a pin in and you know it, you drop dead. But it's people who believe, you can call it a reverse placebo effect. You know, just like a placebo effect, somebody takes a fake pill and they think it makes them better, so a certain percentage of people get better. There's actually a reverse placebo. If a person believes that this is going to kill them, then even if it's innocuous, it actually kills them. In fact, this could even be the meaning of a chazal. Chazal say, depending how you learn, when chazal talk about shedim and chazal talk about certain things that are dangerous, so there's a statement in chazal that says, if you worry about it, then you are subject to it. If you don't worry about it, it will have no effect on you. You've seen that, Lashon? So you can learn it different ways, but one possible, it's only a possible interpretation, is that Chazal are actually saying a lot of this is totally worthless, but if you worry about it, it will affect you, because it becomes like a reverse placebo. I mean, that's possible. I'm not saying that's the only pshat, but that is a possible pshat. If you're choshesh, you have to be choshesh for it, because it'll affect you.
Okay. Well, they were brought up in the first place, then.
Say again?
Well, they were brought up in the first place, then.
Yeah, that's correct. So, but I think the assumption is that, you see, you have to understand that this type of information was very different than the way it is today. Today, we only know this from the Gemara. But Chazal were addressing popular things that people knew in society. In other words, Chazal were not the ones teaching people about these beliefs. People knew this. So Chazal are therefore telling people that if you don't believe in it, it's not going to affect you. So you can't ask a kasha, why did Chazal bring it up? Chazal brought it up because these were things that already were nispashet among the Yam. Okay. The question is, why should we teach it? That's a good question. But once again, it's part of Torah. You know, once it's part of... Of course, that raises a whole other question, just getting from one topic to another. That is, this is apropos of not... This has nothing to do with my topic, but Agav. It's not an easy thing to define what makes something Torah. For example, we understand... We talk about halacha, what you're supposed to, what you're not supposed to. That's Torah, because Kodesh Baruch Hu gives us halacha. We understand if we talk about the avos, the imahos, we talk about the personalities in Tanakh, that's Torah. But the problem is, you have many, many things which are in the Gemara, let's say. For example, the Gemara gives you medical advice, which the Rishonim already say that we don't follow today. Or the Torah or the Gemara describes what might be interpreted as superstitions that will only hurt you if you believe in them. So the question is, if you read the five blot of Gemara on medical advice that we don't even follow today, are you learning Torah? Or, in other words, does it become Torah because it's in the Gemara? Would you have to say Birchas HaTorah on it? So Rav Chaim Kanevsky said, but again, I mean, this these one who says, if it's in the Gemara, it's medical, it's Torah. I mean, in other words, if I would read the same information, see, halacha is Torah whether I read it in the Gemara or whether I read it in an English book, because it's intrinsically Torah. But certain things only become Torah when they're in the context of a sacred book. That's a hard thing to grasp a little bit. It becomes Torah because it's in the book. It's hard. It's a bit of a tzarchian, exactly. How are you magdir? Another example. The first four chapters of the Rambam, I don't know if you ever looked at it, of Hilchos Yesodei HaTorah, are an Aristotelian description of the universe. And it's taken from Aristotle. If you look at the Kesef Mishnah, there's no Mukher and Chazal for it in particular. It's really taken from Aristotle, but the Rambam felt that to understand HaKadosh Baruch Hu as capacity as creator of the world, you needed to have an overall structure of the universe. And the structure that the Rambam uses is the Aristotelian structure of concentric spheres. Yeah, I'm going into all of that. In other words, the concept is that stars, planets, and the moon are like in glass orbs that rotate, etc. Right? That's what the Rambam says. Now the question becomes, if I would take Aristotle and I would read exactly the same stuff, nobody would say that's Torah. You're reading Aristotle. So the fact that it's in the Rambam, again, just raising it as a bit of a kasha. Like, well, what defines something as a chefza of Torah? Now, you might answer, well, if it's true, it's Torah, but that can't be, because much of science, not all of it, is true. But that's called chachma, right? Chachma is not Torah. We say chachma by goyim tamin. If they tell you there is wisdom by the goyim, we believe it. Torah by goyim al tamin. So chachma and Torah are two sources of truth, although Torah is obviously a much higher source of truth. So the fact that something's true doesn't make it Torah. Otherwise, you can make birchas Torah before you do a geometry problem. You know, Euclid's theorem. I mean, nobody's going to say that. Okay, so it's a little confusing exactly. What is even a very simple question? You see, you learned so many years, you have questions. What makes Torah Torah when it's not directly connected to halacha or something in the Chumash. It's also, again, what can you think about in a bathroom, right? Also is a question. If you know, you're not allowed to think about Torah, you can think about Chachma, right? Could I think about what the Gemara says about medicine, right? That's actually a practical halakha. Yeah.
But when the Rambam decided that people needed to know this in the context of Torah, wasn't he saying, like, this is Torah? Regardless of where I put it, like this, what this is Torah over here, and I want people to know that it's Torah, so I'm going to put it in my book.
So the question becomes: if a judgment is made that something is necessary or helpful to one's faith in Hashem, okay? But that again, but even that's kind of tricky because after all, you know, people say that by understanding science, in fact, the Rambam says, by understanding science, you can get a deeper appreciation of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Okay? By looking at the wonders of creation. So, once again, so wouldn't that mean that pure, you know, studying science would become Torah? And yet we wouldn't say that, right? We wouldn't. So you're saying only the science that's actually put into a book of Torah becomes Torah.
But, I mean, maybe
that's what Chaim Kineski said, but, you know, yeah.
Maybe it would depend on your motivation?
Well, I hear, but again, you're saying a big chinish. If I am motivated to learn science because I want to get closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, now I agree, I would say that the science becomes a religious activity. But to call it Limud HaTorah, I think would be stretching it. It's a new excuse for missing Morning Seder, right? Missing Morning Seder and studying for a physics exam. So it's part of my Avodah Hashem. So it's a little hard. Okay, but going back to this vort, so the Meshech Chachma says we have four dangers that a slave faces. The danger to his physical survival, the danger to his spiritual identity, lack of history, lack of hope. And because these are four dangers, we have four geulas from those dangers. But now the Meshech Chachma goes further. Gevaldik, the Meshech Chachma says, but you know, in order to be saved from these dangers, we can't just sit back and have Hashem do it. We have to have some type of hisayiris, some type of awakening from our side, which counteracts the four dangers. This is called, in the language of Kabbalah, Isarusa Dilatata. I don't know if you've come across that expression. Isarusa Dilatata is Aramaic. An awakening from below. And the awakening from below brings down Isarusa Deliela, the Hisoiris, the awakening from above. So what did we do, as it were, to counteract the four dangers which brought down HaKadosh Baruch Hu's four redemptions? So here the Meshech Chachma brings a medrash. Now you've heard parts of this medrash in different versions because the Gemara brings it differently. But the Meshech Chachma uses the Medrash that says that even though the Jewish people were on the 49 level of Tumah, there were four merits that they had for which they were Zocha to leave Mitzrayim. Now, this would be a slightly different list than you may have heard, but this is based on the Mechilta. The Mechilta is the Halachic Medrash on Shmos. The Mechilta says that the Jews were Zocha to be redeemed because, number one, they didn't intermarry. They were faithful to their wives. There was only, Rashi brings in Chumash, there was only one case. Remember the guy that was a blasphemer, the guy that cursed Hashem? So the Torah says his father was an Egyptian and his mother was a Jewish woman. And Rashi says that was the only case in Mitzrayim of any type of interrelationship. So they were faithful to their wives, and they did not intermarry. That's Sechus number one. Yeah.
That means that the Egyptians didn't rape any of the Jewish women.
That would also mean that somehow the Jews were able to preserve themselves even from rape. Yes, that's correct. Number two, they did not speak Lashon Hara against each other. But I want to point out that in this context, we don't just mean they were from, but it means the following. You have to understand what it means. They didn't speak Lashon Hara. That is, when people are oppressed, they will often collaborate with the oppressor by informing the oppressor of various things in order to get some advantages. This unfortunately happened even during the Holocaust, where sometimes there were Jews who would work with the Nazis as informers on other Jews in the hope that they would get some benefit. Now, in truth, it didn't help them at all. They may have bought time a few months here or there, and eventually, you know, they were usually killed as well. But when we say they didn't speak Lashon Hara, what it really means is they didn't collaborate with the Egyptians to buy temporary advantages by informing on the deeds of their fellow Jews. They presented a united front. Even the taskmasters, Rashi brings, the Jewish taskmasters who were in charge of being sure that the Jews did work, if a Jew didn't do his quota, the taskmaster would not inform the Egyptians which Jew didn't do his job, and the taskmasters were beaten. Even the guys, Dasan and Aviram, who were big troublemakers, right? You would hardly call them righteous. And it's amazing that they made the cut of the 20% that got redeemed. But they had great zechus. Dasan was a taskmaster. Remember, when the Egyptian is beating the Jew, and Moshe kills the Egyptian, Rashi says, the Jew that's being beaten was one of the taskmasters who refused to inform on another Jew. And he's getting beaten, and Moshe kills the Egyptian by using the name of Hashem. Of course, it just shows you that Dasan's life is saved, right, by Moshe Rabbeinu's intervention. He then turns to Moshe later and says, oh, you're going to kill me? Like, you know, it's like he takes what Moshe did to save his life and turns it against him.
Did he tell Paro also?
Huh?
He went and told Paro about it.
He went and told Paro, that's right, that's right. That's right, that's what Moshe says. It's now become known. So that's kind of a crazy example. The very person who saved your life, you know, you turned against them. But still, Dasan had his zechus, that Dasan was willing to be beaten. To be beaten, not to turn a fellow Jew in. Why he did it to Moshe? That's an interesting question.
Did everyone know Moshe?
Maybe he didn't know. That's actually a possibility, because at that point in his life, Moshe was known as the Prince of Egypt. It's not clear at that stage that Dasan even knew that Moshe was Jewish. That is a possibility. Moshe was the Prince of Egypt who was walking around looking at the Jews suffering and trying to help them, but nobody really knew who he was yet. Then that is a very good possibility, yeah.
He knew that he killed him, and he didn't, like, go up and stab him. I mean, he used the name of Hashem. I would think maybe he would know.
He should have figured that out. Yeah.
Yeah.
And maybe he figured it was a heart attack. Who knows? Maybe Moshe was big. the guy dies of fright. I don't. Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, if you accept the Medrash, Chumash doesn't say it literally, but if you accept the Medrash that Moshe killed him b'shem Hashem, it would be hard for Dasan not to figure that out at that particular point. But, you know, who knows? Who knows? It's a good question. Okay, but be it as it may, therefore, the first zechus is no intermarriage. The second zechus is no Lashon Hara, which we're interpreting to mean you don't inform on Jews to get advantage. The third, which the Gemara brings in sight at, is they didn't change their names. They kept their Hebrew names. And the fourth is they didn't change their language. They spoke Lashon HaKodesh. Now, there are other midrashim that talk about Jewish clothing, but let's go with the Mechilta, because that's what the Mishnah Chacham goes with. So according to the Mechilta's list, the four merits are no intermarriage, no Lashon Hara, no changing of names, and no changing of language. Now, the Mishnah Chacham very beautifully says, each of these behaviors counteract some of the dangers that slavery could have inflicted on us, and therefore we merited four redemptions. He says the following. Let's first look at spiritual assimilation, although I mentioned that second bit, but the spiritual assimilation, says the greatest bulwark against spiritual assimilation is the holiness that exists between a husband and a wife. When a husband and a wife create a home, that home, no matter what is going on outside, no matter how turbulent the world is, no matter how corrupt, no matter how evil, the kedusha of a bayis is like a miniature Beis Hamikdash. Now, it's true, the Jews were on the 49th level of Tumah, meaning obviously their homes were not mamish like a Beis Hamikdash, but to the degree that they were faithful to each other, that created some element of kedusha that was matzil them from sharnun. That is why marriage is called kiddushin, holiness, sanctification. Okay, so the protection against spiritual assimilation, legabri, was the Kedushas Habayis. Chazal also say, Kol HaPoresh Min Arayos, if you separate from improper Arayos, Nikra Kadesh, that is called Kedusha. See, this is a special Indian, these weeks of Shavuot, right? Shavuot, Shmos, Parshiyos, Shmos, Va'era, Bo, Bashalach, Yisro, Mishpatim, Shavuot, and some add two more weeks, Shavuot, Tat, Truma, Tzaveh, are actually weeks which are devoted to this idea of being misaken oneself in sexual matters. So married people, for example, might review the laws of Nida, and single people, you know, we focus on Shmiras Einayim, you know, various other inyanim, a lot like that. But be it as it may, because it facilitates Kedusha, right? So the spiritual protection they had was the faithfulness to their bias. Okay. Now, second danger, which is the first one that I mentioned, was physical survival. There, the great bulwark is Lashon Hara. Why? The Meshech Chachma says he doesn't just mean because of the ruchnius thing, if you don't speak Lashon Hara, God will give you a long life. But even in a material way, you can understand this. That when each Jew was connected to another Jew and would never give up to protect himself, when there's achdus and unity, the enemies will not be able to destroy us. And therefore, the great thing that protected Am Yisrael on a physical level was the achdus and love they had for each other, that they wouldn't speak Lashon Hara. Benjamin Franklin is said to have remarked, either when they signed the Constitution or the Declaration of Independence, Franklin was on both documents, for one of them, I think after the Declaration of Independence, it sounds more mistabra. He said that we must surely hang all together, for if not, we will hang separately. Meaning, we're either together or united we stand, you know, divided we fall. Sticks, right? You give somebody mishalom, right? You take 100 sticks. If you pick each stick up separately, you can snap it. Pick up 100 sticks or even 10 sticks together, can't break it. That when there's achdus, there is strength, there is kayach. Hashem blesses us. Rashi brings a chazal that the Dor HaMabul, which was a social disintegration, where people were stealing from each other, Hashem destroyed totally. The Dor HaFlaga, the Tower of Babel, where they were rebelled against Hashem, but there was shalom and unity between them. Hashem dispersed because it was a dangerous collaboration, but he did not destroy. And Rashi brings a chazal that says, that in Parshas Noach, from here we see that HaKadosh Baruch Hu might be mevater, he might forgive even Avodah Zarah, when there's Achdus and Avas Yisrael, but he will destroy a world where there's a breakdown of unity and Achdus. Right? This is an amazing, amazing chazal that Rashi brings. Okay, so not intermarrying was the antidote, so to speak, to spiritual assimilation. Not speaking Lashon Hara was the protection against physical destruction. Now, the third sakana was lack of history. That's not changing your name. Because think about it. Jews always name people. Sometimes you make up new names, but not that often. In Israel, they sometimes do make up new names. But generally speaking, we're always named after somebody from the past. Now, Ashkenazim name after relatives who are no longer alive. Svardim will name even after relatives who are alive, but it's always an earlier generation. So if your name is Avraham, now maybe you're named after Uncle Avraham, or maybe you're named after Avraham Avinu. But either way, it reminds you of your past. It reminds you of your yichas. It reminds you that you don't come out of nowhere. You have a Bubby, you have a Zaidi, you know, you go back. And then you have a sense that, you know, you're not just coming out of nowhere. You know, even Yiddish expressions for names have such a thing. You know, sometimes parents will call their children Bubbala, Mamala, Tatala, Zedala, although that's a common. And people just think, well, Bubbala just means it's an affectionate name. No, not really. Think about this. A Bubby is a grandmother. So here's the thing. Let's imagine you name your child after your grandmother, who's not alive. So every time you talk to the child, you call her little grandmother. Number one, it's a way of showing respect that you don't refer to your grandmother by her name. Although halakhically, that's not a problem, because if I name somebody with the same name as my father or my grandmother, whatever it is, I'm not talking about my parent with their name. But be it as it may, it's a way of extra kavod. And it's also reminding this child all the time that this child comes from a family, comes from a yichus, comes from a... Right? So a name is a great way of being reminded of your past all the time. Okay? So you see how the Meshech Chacham was doing it. The four dangers for which we needed four redemptions had four behaviors mitzidenu. Now, I didn't do the fourth one yet. That protected us. Now, the fourth one is a slave lacks a sense of hope for the future. That is counteracted by maintaining the Hebrew language. Because think about it. You know, even 50 years ago, you know, they used to teach Latin in schools much more often. In fact, in law and medicine, you know, Latin was a required language for many years, but no longer. And even in the Catholic Church, although some old-timers are against it, but, you know, officially, the Mass does not have to be said in Latin. Now it's the priest can have a guitar, whatever it is. It's all said. I don't like what happened to the Catholic Church. Not sure. Anyway, but the thing is, you know, the 2-2 reform. But the thing is, nobody is talking about reinstituting Latin. Or, you know, here in the Middle East, there were ancient languages, Hittite, the Chiti, Assyrian. Now, there are scholars that might be studying this in universities, but nobody's talking about, let's have high school courses in Assyrian or Hittite. Why? Because these are cultures that are gone. They're not coming back. If a culture is extinct, there's no movement to continue a language. It's a dead culture, and therefore it's a dead language. Maybe of interest to scholars, and maybe of interest to be able to decipher things that you find, you know, from thousands of years ago. But there's no relevance to day-to-day life. Lashon HaKodesh could have been the same thing. If a Jew really believed, there's no hope. If a Jew really believed we're never coming out of Egypt, we're never coming out of Golus, then what would the purpose be in teaching your child Lashon HaKodesh? But every time a parent, this is what the Meshech Chachma says, taught their child Lashon HaKodesh, the parent was saying to the child, we're not going to be here forever. There will be a time, maybe not in my lifetime and maybe not in your lifetime, in which we're going to come back to our land, we're going to have our society, we're going to serve Hashem. Now, maybe they didn't know about Torah, that's an interesting question. What did they know? That's always going to be a question. What did the average Jew know? But at least the Meshech Chachma says, maintaining a Lashon is an affirmation of hope that there will be a future Geula. Yeah.
I mean, what would they have done If they didn't have any hope, what would they have done with the language? Like the Roman Empire, they were speaking Latin until they fell. The big empires spoke their language until they fell, even after. They didn't change it, even when they knew they were going to fall.
No, I understand, but they're already in Egypt, so they might as well raise their children to say, listen, we're in Egypt, this is where we're going to be, this is where we are, so we'll just speak Egyptian. I mean, why teach my children? I mean, in other words, we're living in Egypt. If you really believe this is where you're going to... I mean, I'll give you an example. This even happened once again. Think about the parallels to America. Many parents did not, European parents, whose Yiddish was their language, you know, they didn't teach their children Yiddish. And the children of Yiddish-speaking parents, I mean, some know Yiddish, some don't, but many, many children of Yiddish-speaking parents just don't know Yiddish. Because the parents figured, what's the purpose of teaching them? Which is unfortunate, because Yiddish itself is a very beautiful and spiritual language. But that's beside the point. But that's exactly what could have happened in Mitzrayim. The children of Yaakov knew Hebrew, but you know, once they're slaves, you know, why teach that language? You know, teach the language of the prevailing culture. But the Meshech Chachma says it's an affirmation of hope. It's a statement that we're not here forever. That's why there is something to be said about the revival of modern Hebrew. You know, the truth is, the revival of modern Hebrew, okay, we can debate whether what is called the Ivrit is the same as Lashon HaKodesh. you know, when you put in words like televisia or telephone, you know, one would not call that part of the Hebrew language per se. But, you know, as you know, the so-called founder of modern Hebrew was a guy who lived the end of the 19th century, the very beginning of the 20th century, Eliezer Perlman, a guy who came from Russia, and he Hebrewized his name to Eliezer ben Yehuda. And he really did quite a job. He was really a fanatic on this, because many people felt that Hebrew could not be a daily spoken language. Some people felt that way for religious reasons. It should only be for Kedusha. On the other hand, the Anias Daiti, it's very, very difficult to say that Hashem doesn't want Hebrew to be a language of daily discourse, because in Mitzrayim, where the Medrash is Mishabeach Am Yisrael for maintaining Hebrew, they were not using Hebrew for Divrei Torah. They were over the Avodah Zarah. And some people felt, on the other side of the coin, that Hebrew didn't have enough words that would reflect modern culture. So words had to be made up. A word for computer, a word for camera, right? So Eliezer ben Yehuda kind of invented words for everything. Of course, he didn't have everything that we have today, but whatever was there. And he used to base it on Midrashim and Gemaras, and he used to go to Rabbanim and ask them, you know, what this word in the Medrash means, and then he would adopt it. So the problem is, though, he was not only non-religious, he was kind of anti-religious in many ways. So although Rav Kook was willing to talk to him, etc., because Rav Kook talked to everybody, I mean, I'm saying it as a Mila, not as a Kisari. Rav Kook talked to everybody, but many Kanoim in Yerushalayim felt very, very strongly against him. And the truth is, he was actually a Kanoi himself in the other direction. If he just would not have been religious, that would have been, you know, one thing, but he was kind of anti in many, many ways. So he's a bit of a controversial. His house is right outside of Mea Sharim. It's a little museum, Ethiopia Street. And you'll see graffiti on the house all the time. You know, the Israeli government cleans it off, and somebody else puts it on again. So he's a controversial guy, Eliezer Ben Yehuda. But I would have to say, though, that the Meshech Chachma is teaching us, Taka, that the maintenance of Lashon HaKodesh is an affirmation in your belief of Geula, that Golos is not permanent. So now you see the Meshech Chachma structure. I have one more piece to add to the puzzle. That we have four dangers for which we need four behaviors on our part, Isarusa Bilvatata, to address those dangers. And then we're Zocha to the four redemptions from those dangers. Now, last point of the puzzle is the Meshech Chochmah says, this is even Merumas, where we drink the four cups of wine. The different parts of the Seder that were Merumas, although it doesn't follow the order here exactly. The first cup of Dalet Kosos is drunk after Kiddush. We say Kiddush and drink the wine. So he says, Kiddush is connected the holiness of the bias. That's the spiritual assimilation, which was countered by the Kedusha of the faithfulness of not intermarrying. And Kiddush is a remiss to Kiddushin, marriage. And Kiddush is supposed to be said in the place where you live, the Makom Suda, right? The Makom of the Bias. So therefore he says, the Kos of Kiddush is the Kos of the spiritual faithfulness of husband and wife, which was the protection against the spiritual assimilation. Now, the second cup is drunk after you've recited the historical Haggadah. Okay? So that part of the Haggadah is describing our past, our history, the promises Hashem made to the Avos, right? The Maggid, the Ten Makos. In other words, what is that about? It's connecting yourself to the past. That gives you your sense of history. That's the zchus of not changing your name. Right? So the second kos is celebrating the history of Am Yisrael. In fact, that's the Iker of the Yitzias Mitzrayim. The Iker of Avodah Yitzias Mitzrayim is to be mashrish to ourselves and our children. The history of the Jewish people, the Hashgacha Pratis of Hashem in taking care of us. Now, the third kais is the kais upon which we recite benching, Birkas HaMazon. Now, this is a little more subtle. The Meshech Chachma says, what is Birkas HaMazon about? Birchas HaMazon is about Hakaras HaTov, gratitude to Hashem for all that Hashem has given you. Hakaras HaTov. When there's Hakaras HaTov for what Hashem has given you, you don't have jealousy or hatred of other people, because you're grateful, you're Sameach Bechelka. So Hakaras HaTov is a foundation for Achdus and unity and love, because you no longer are jealous of other people. So therefore, the third case is Keneged, what we need for physical survival, and that is not speaking Lashon Hara, which in turn is based on Achdus and solidarity, and that comes from Hakaras HaTov, what Hashem has given you. Okay, so the first case is the spiritual assimilation, Keneged, the faithfulness of the bias. The second coast is not changing names, sense of history. Third coast is gratitude, not speaking Lashon Hara, sense of unity. Now, the fourth coast, which we drink after benching, on that fourth coast we recite Hallel. Now, if you remember, the Hallel of Leil Seder is split into two. We say a little bit of the Hallel before the meal, and most of the Hallel after the meal. The Rishayim say the reason why Hallel is split is it is only the first part of Hallel that's talking about Yetzias Mitzrayim. The second part of Hallel is looking towards the future Geula of Mashiach. And that is why we begin it by opening the door for Eliyahu HaNavi. So it turns out that the last kos is about our hope and our belief in a future Geula, which in turn refers to teaching Lashon HaKodesh, right? So in other words, so again, in this very beautiful structure, we have four dangers, four behaviors, four celebrations in the Seder of these different behaviors, culminating in the four redemptions of HaKodesh Baruch Hu from these four dangers, right? That the Yisarusa Doliela, the Yisarus, the awakening that comes from above, has to be triggered by some type of Yisarus from below, right? And these areas from below are these behaviors of faithfulness in our marriages, in our relationships, Shmiras Habris, in terms of Achdus and Avas Yisrael, not speaking Lashon Hara, having a sense of Kesher to the our history, and having a sense of hope and belief that there will be a Geula HaAsida. We should be zeichet to that, Ben Heirav Yameinu. Okay, good Shabbos.